At current state, on Monday, April 7th, I'm Joe Lindstroth in for Mark Bayshore today. Mark's out with the flu. It seems like the flu, as the seasons change here into the spring, is going around. Quite a few people here in the office have the flu, including the host, Mark Bayshore, which puts me in the hot seat today on Monday. A great show for you coming up today. We will hear a little bit of poetry from a mid-Michigan author. Also, we'll hear about the business leaders of Michigan's turnaround plan. And one MSU graduate student took some information to heart that his grandfather used to tell him stories about working his way through college. And he crunched some numbers and thought, you know, that's not possible to do for today's undergrads. And sure enough, the data show that it is impossible to do. And it's gotten a bit of buzz on The Atlantic and on Reddit. So we'll speak with MSU student here who talks about student finances in the 21st century in undergraduate education. But first, road funding here in Michigan. It's no secret there are potholes and potholes everywhere in Michigan. Last week, the Michigan House Republicans proposed a new funding plan that would allocate nearly $500 million each year through 2018 to repair the state's crumbling roads and bridges. It's a start, many say, but the proposal does not come close to the $2 billion a year some experts are claiming we need to maintain our roads. And since that's not enough to fix everything, priorities must be identified and decisions made as to where the money goes and which roads get fixed first. Certainly everyone wants their own neighborhood streets and highways at the top of the repair list, but transportation planners and engineers must rely on hard data to make decisions about which roads get fixed and when. And lately, they've also had to rely on some politics. Joining me today to talk about prioritizing road repair is Bill Conklin. He's the managing director of the Ingham County Road Department. He's joining me by phone. Welcome, Bill.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Also here in the studio, Jeff Reed is an associate region engineer with the Michigan Department of Transportation. Welcome to Current State, Jeff.
Thanks, Joe. Good morning.
Road repair is a cyclical process, gentlemen. You pretty much know about what you're going to get at the end of each winter. However, this winter was particularly brutal on the roads. Jeff, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the worst, assess the state of our roads here in Michigan for us.
Well, at the current time, you look at the condition of the roads statewide, and we're still at a fairly high level of good and fair roads right now. You look at the potholes we have right now, and you might disagree with that, but our data would show that we're still in an area of about 80 to 85% good and fair roads at the time. Now, if you start to project those numbers out into the future, it does get to be a little bit grim. And by the year 2018, we're looking at roads being about 50%. Good and fair, with 50% being poor.
Bill Conklin with Ingham County, would you kind of agree with that overall statewide assessment, or are the Ingham County roads a little better, a little worse?
Our roads are in a little bit worse shape. We're about 30-35% poor condition, about 60% fair, and about 10-15% good, depending on whether you're talking our primary or local system. The state roads, I would agree, are in a little bit better shape, but the local roads are not quite as in good shape.
How exactly do you measure the state of a road? Jeff, let's start. How do you at the state measure that?
Yeah, we have an asset management principled process that we use, and we collect a lot of data on our roads. The cracking that you see on the roads, different types of cracking, the potholes. We also look at things like rutting, the roughness of the ride, things like that, that all add up to a condition level of each individual segment of roadway that we have.
Now, do you have crews that actually physically go out there on the roads and measure these things? Is it through computer analysis? There's also a PASER system, P-A-S-E-R system,
right,
that you use.
Yeah, we actually have a contractor that goes out and does a laser measurement of the road and photographs every 50 feet, takes a snapshot every 50 feet every other year for all the roads. So we cover 100% of our roads every 2 years, and then we use those images and those measurements to come up with the condition state.
And Bill Conklin in Ingham County, in the Ingham County Roads Department, is this data that you rely on as well, or does the county do additional things to look at our roads here in Ingham County?
Well, our PACER rating system is based really on more visual and ride quality assessment of the roads. Our raters also rate all of our roads every 2 years. We don't have access to the funding for those high tech bands that laser image the roads and that type of thing. But our raters review the ride quality of the road and also the extent and severity of distress that they observe on the roads, and give them a rating from 1 to 10. 10 being a brand new road, 1 being a nearly failed road. So that's done every 2 years, and we've got several years worth of data, and we can project the condition of our roads going forward, and also use that to plan maintenance activities.
And with that information, Bill, I assume, do you have a list of priorities in terms of which roads should be treated first or worked on first here in Ingham County?
Yeah, we have actually several lists. We have a list of roads that need rehabilitation. We have a list of roads that need maintenance to maintain them in a fair to better condition. We use that to and as well as traffic volumes and importance of the road link in our network to prioritize both our maintenance activities and our larger rehabilitation projects.
And Jeff Reed, Associate Region Engineer with the Michigan Department of Transportation at MDOT, how do you prioritize roads at the state level with MDOT?
It's very similar to what Bill just mentioned. We do have a 5-year plan that's out there that anybody can get on our website, and you can see what major work we have coming up over the next 5 years. But we do a lot of the same things that Bill was talking about. We look at our higher level, higher importance roads, the freeways, get a little higher priority than some of the non-freeway roads. We look at condition. We look at the amount of traffic on there, and like you said, the importance of the links out there. So right now we're very heavily focused on freeway reconstruction. We also use what we call a mix of fixes. And again, like Bill said, we try to keep our good and fair roads in good and fair condition. So a lot of times you'll see us out there working on a road that you might think, well, this road doesn't need any work. There's a much worse road over here, but we're trying to keep that road in that better condition when we already know that road over there is poor and it'll cost a lot more money to upgrade that road than it will to keep that road in good and fair condition.
So are there certain kind of formulas or measurements? For example, car owners, every 2,000 to 3,000 miles, we get an oil change. Every 80,000 to 90,000 miles, maybe we're looking at the timing belt. Mm-hmm. You know, as you're looking at roads, are there certain aspects or points in which you need to replace something or change something in order to maintain it to a good or fair condition, Jeff?
Well, ideally, yes. Right now, though, the way we're operating right now, a lot of it's based on funding. And when you look at how we're reconstructing and doing the major work on our roads, we can work on about 1%, do a reconstruction on 1% of our roads, which if you think about it, that means you're going to reconstruct a road every 100 years. And that's just not adequate to keep the roads in good condition.
And Bill Conklin, we were talking about priorities that you've developed here. When you get money allocated from the state for road funding, how does that work? Are you able to use that money as you see fit with the priorities that you've identified?
For the most part, yet, but I would agree with what Jeff said. We don't have sufficient funding to be attacking the program at all the levels that we should be. Ideally, we would be touching our roads every 5 to 10 years with slurry seals and chip seals. We don't have anywhere near the funding to do that, to maintain our fair and good roads in fair and good condition, also crack filling. And we don't have sufficient funding on the low end to be rehabilitating all of our poor roads. Generally, at all levels, our roads are descending in condition and quality a little bit as time goes on, because we don't have funding at all those levels. Now, in terms of prioritizing the roads, typically we use our federal funding to rehabilitate our larger projects that have gotten to the point where they need either a reconstruction or more likely a rehabilitation. Staff recommends those to our countywide Road Advisory Board, which is comprised of a representative from each township. From there, our County Board of Commissioners signs off on the recommendations, and from there it goes to our Metropolitan Planning Organization, which is prescribed by federal funding, which here in Ingham County is our Tri-County Regional Planning Commission. That has several levels, all of which involve opportunities for public involvement, and that results in a 3 or 4 year transportation improvement plan that feeds into the state transportation improvement plan, which might be what Jeff was referring to as a 5 year plan. And at each of those steps, there's opportunities for public involvement, public comment, or the plan itself can be commented upon by reviewing it on Tri-County Regional Planning Commission's website. So we recommend based on pavement conditions, we recommend on traffic volumes, and again, importance in our network, and then at several levels, it's approved and it becomes our multi-year transportation improvement plan.
I'm Joe Lindstroth in for Mark Bayshore. You're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm speaking with Bill Conklin there on the phone, who's the managing director of the Ingham County Road Department. And with me in the studio is Jeff Reed, associate region engineer with the Michigan Department of Transportation. We're talking about road funding and prioritizing it here on Current State. I wanted to bring up politics a little bit, gentlemen. Chris Gouts in Crane's Business last week reported that there's been considerable partisanship lately when it comes to road funding. The last special allocations bill, which is part of the overall state budget, allocated $115 million, same that's going now. And not a single House Democrat had a road project approved in that allocation. 45 of 59 House Republicans had at least one approved. Now, the House Republican spokesperson said that's because the House Democrats did not vote for the overall budget bill, and so they were kind of frozen out. Of the Senate Democrats, just two were approved of this last allocation. To what extent, Jeffrey, does MDOT have control over the prioritizing of this budget? Is this what happened over the last year, something usual as far as road funding goes?
Typically, no. For that particular program, the $115 million you talked about, we created a list of needs that we have, and there's no shortage of needs out there for road improvements. We submitted a list of needs to our leadership, and the projects were selected. Typically, in our regions, we are allowed to select the projects that we see fit. It goes through a lot of review, a lot of scrutiny, through different processes we have when we select a project. But typically, we select good candidate projects, and they go through and get selected.
And Bill Conk in Ingham County, were there any special new road projects funded in the last allocation?
I was just going to comment that I had not heard about that. I had heard about the allocation that occurred in December. There was $115 million allocated in December, and Ingham County was awarded $1.7 million for the reconstruction of Michigan Avenue between Waverly Road and Clare Street in Lansing Township. There was to be another allocation to occur in either February or March, and I have not heard the results of that. If Ingham County was awarded a project, I haven't heard about it, or perhaps maybe the reason I haven't heard is because we weren't awarded another project, but I'm not aware of that having occurred or not.
And moving forward in this new allocation, to what extent do you think MDOT will have independence into what it decides where the funding goes for road priorities?
Yeah, I really couldn't say. I think it'll work a lot like the last one. We're going to identify needs, and what happens beyond that is beyond my knowledge or control.
Jeffrey, obviously certain states don't get the kind of freeze-thaw issues that we get here in Michigan. Do you know of any other cold winter states that come up with a reasonable solution to keep up funding on the roads that we can look at as a model? Are you looking at how other states are doing this at all right now?
With the freeze thaw, I mean, this is a tough year to look at and use as an example, because it was so cold for so long. The frost got so deep into the road, much more than usual. You got probably a little more of that frost heave, and it did make the roads deteriorate probably more quickly than usual. So, we always are looking for ways to improve. We've had a lot of improvements on our maintenance side as far as snow clearing, things like that. We're always looking for innovations, technology that we can use. So, yeah, we look to other states. We look at what's available out there, and we will implement anything that will help us out.
And Bill Conklin, from the county perspective, are there any other counties in this state or any other municipalities here in the Midwest with similar conditions that you've been looking at to kind of look at other different prioritizing methods or funding models at all that have been useful for you?
Well, we're of course, similar to quite a few of the counties here in mid-Michigan in terms of climate and geography in other states as well. Michigan is a little bit unique in that we tend to have, especially lower Michigan, in that we tend to have a fair number of freeze-thaw cycles each winter. Now, this particular winter, we didn't have quite as many because, frankly, it stayed cold and the frost drove deep into the ground. In a way, that helped, but then with the deep frost penetration, we've had a pretty severe spring thaw. With multiple freeze-thaw cycles each winter, kind of driven by Michigan's microclimate, by the lakes here, that tends to be hard on roads. A road either wants to stay unfrozen or to stay frozen all winter and just go through a quick and mild thaw fairly quickly. If there's a deep frost penetration like we had this year, or there's quite a bit of cycling back and forth between freeze and thawing, that's going to play havoc on the roads as it has in the past couple of years. And in terms of road prioritization, I believe in conferring with other road agencies, both in our Tri-County Regional Planning Commission here in the Tri-County area and around the state through our County Road Association of Michigan, comparing notes, we find that other counties are doing fairly similar to what we're doing, and all are suffering from, frankly, a lack of funding to do everything that should be done at all levels, good, fair, and poor.
And real quickly, just a little less than a minute, Bill, where are you prioritizing in Ingham County with this new allocation? Where would you fix first here in this county?
Well, a lot of that's going to be depending on the rules that come out with that funding, but certainly in both our rural and urban areas, we have primary roads that need to be done. Lake Lansing Road, Hagedorn Road, Jolly Road, Dobie Road are some roads up in the Meridian metro area that need doing, Cedar Street all through Delhi Township and many of our primary roads out in the rural areas, including Meridian Road and all down through our county, some of which we're going to be doing with federal aid this year. Like Jeff said, there's no shortage of choices where road work is needed.
And real quickly, Jeff, on the state level, are there areas that you're targeting specifically first?
Well, in our region, which is around the Lansing area, the road that we're taking a look at is Martin Luther King, M99, on the south side of Lansing. We're taking a look at that one as far as what we can do with this funding.
Brutal.
Yeah.
That's brutal. Well, thank you both for joining me. Bill Conklin is the Managing Director of the Ingham County Road Department, and Jeff Reed is an Associate Region Engineer with the Michigan Department of Transportation. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Current state on WKAR, I'm Joe Lindstroth, in for an ill Mark Bayshore on a Monday today. Poetry, art, and Michigan, we celebrate it here on Current State, all have inspired local writer and artist Jean Van Wieren. The Williamston Enterprise columnist has published a book of her art and poetry called This Mitten is Tightly Knit. And Current State Scott Pohl spoke with her about the book. Hi, Scott.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Why,
good to have
thank
you on the
you.
Show. It's Poetry Month. We like talking about poetry on Current State. And Jean Van Wieren's art has been displayed around Williamston, and her column has been featured in the local paper. But putting her poetry out there for all to see is something new for her.
I started writing poetry, oh gosh, probably about 20, 25 years ago. And it would just sort of be something I'd would pop into my head, and I'd put it in my journal because I used to keep a daily journal. And then I started making sure I had a Christmassy one every year because I made my own Christmas cards. And after I had started painting, a good friend of mine said, well, you should do something with your poetry and your paintings, because she got a Christmas card every year and knew I did both. And so that was sort of her nudging me that resulted in the book.
I know you've done a fair amount of writing for the local newspaper in Williamston, perhaps other writing I'm not aware of. Putting your stuff in book form and putting it out there, any nervousness about taking that step?
Yes, because I was really, really horrified there would be like a typo that I wouldn't see. And I mean, I was my own editor. So poetry is very personal. It's a very personal kind of writing. And I suppose I should be more concerned about it than I am. But it gives people a different view of the writer. And so there's a little bit of a risk there.
The writing you've done for the paper in Williamston, have you ever published poetry in the column you write?
No, I haven't. I have to say that the columns that I've been writing recently, the subjects that have gotten the most interest have been my dog Bernie and pimento cheese. So I don't have any poems about pimento cheese, so I haven't included any.
Let's leap right into the book and have you read one of your poems.
Okay.
Have you chosen one?
I thought I would do one called Messin' with Love.
Jean Van Weeren.
On a November evening when you don't expect it, are nowhere looking for it, love trots in and nudges your shoulder. If you don't respond, love will slap you upside your head. If you think, maybe love will bring me someone shy and quiet, forget it. The lake effect has blown in, and love will match you stride for stride, be the left hand to your right hand, comfort you on a bitter night, and jump with you into the deepest water. Love does not like to be messed with, because love knows you are the best thing ever to happen to each other, and the sound of your laughter is the sound of happiness.
Nice.
Thank you.
You know, a lot of your focus, as you can tell from the title of the book, This Mitten is Tightly Knit, is about Michigan, takes place in Michigan, inspired by Michigan.
Yeah. I love this state. You know, it's got everything. And my mother and father are originally from Dearborn, from the Detroit area. My husband's family is originally from Holland, from the Lake Michigan area, or as I like to call it, the Dutch Riviera. And it's in my DNA, I guess.
Your artwork has been on display around town in Williamston,
mm-hmm.
though.
Tell us
a little bit more about where people may have seen your works.
I belong to a group called Second Monday Artists, and we have regularly had shows at Gracie's Place in Williamston, which is right across from the Williamston Theater, so people may know that. And over the years, I've had shows there. I also have work, both the poetry and some paintings, at Tuesday Books, which is a nice little bookstore in Williamston. I've got some other shows coming up in the fall. I'm going to be at the East Lansing Public Gallery, and some other things are in the works. So you can usually find it in Williamston, but it'll be around other places soon.
All right. Now, I'm going to be honest with our listeners. This isn't some big new book from one of the major publishing houses. This is self-published.
Yep.
Since it's self-published, how are people able to find this book?
You can buy it at Tuesday Books in Williamston. You can also, there's a form that I've posted, and I'll repost on my Facebook, my studio Facebook page, which is Jean Van Weeren - Artwork and Poetry. And it's also available at my Etsy store, which is J. Van Weeren Artwork. So it's a couple of different places. And again, I'm working on getting it out in some other places, too.
And maybe the trunk of your car.
Maybe the trunk of my car.
Okay.
I always carry coffee with me.
So if I wanted to buy it from you today, you would...
I would hand it
you'd
over.
You'd let me fork over some cash and buy it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Excellent. Well, I think before we ring off, it might be fun to hear another poem from the book, especially something with a Michigan focus. Because the book is called This Mitten is Tightly Knit, let's choose one that reveals the Michigan inspiration behind your work.
Okay, this one is called Michigan Produce Stand, September. even before the floods came. New Orleans and its bawdy technicolor religion of bon temps had nothing. Do you hear me, darling? Nothing on the sensuous fecund glory of a farmer's market in Michigan on a September afternoon. There on a tripod of pine crates, bulbous butternut squash loll next to globular rosy-kissed peaches, their soft flesh yielding to the tongue and their sweet funk filling the air, calling indolent sweat bees to come and check their sweetness. The golden light of early autumn lingers on the shiny skins of impossibly large tomatoes, halos each sand-colored muskmelon on a heap in a red and sand-colored basket. Peppers riot in a wooden box. Red on yellow, green or purple, color on color, brilliant and irresistible. The apples in their prim plenty bask wholesome while old friends talk in the fragrant air, but they will burst, juicy and sweet and tangy, in the grasp of tooth and lip.
Jean Van Weeren, we like to talk about poetry here on Current State. Thank you so much for bringing in This Mitten is Tightly Knit, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much, Scott. It's been a pleasure to be here.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
And you can meet Jean Van Weeren, check out her artwork, and hear her poetry Saturday and Sunday, May 3rd and 4th. She'll be in the studio of artist Gretchen Felick on Sherwood Road as part of the Williamston Township Fine Art Sale and Studio Tour. An organization that includes many of Michigan's top corporate leaders is making new recommendations on the way ahead for the state. Business Leaders for Michigan is a nonprofit whose 90 or so members are among the top executives of the state's most established businesses, including General Motors, Domino's Pizza, and Meijer. The group also includes top academic leaders like university presidents Luana Simon and Mary Sue Coleman. Business Leaders for Michigan's 2009 turnaround plan, which called for tax and budget reforms to generate job growth and competitiveness, has been largely implemented by the GOP-led legislature and the Snyder administration. Before he asked CEO Doug Rothwell about the updated plan, Current State's Mark Bayshore asked how he thinks Michigan's circumstances have changed.
Well, if you go back to 2009, when we first came out with the plan, Mark, Michigan was at the bottom of the pack virtually in every metric that you could look at, whether it was income growth, job growth, population. We were the only state in the country for that decade that actually, that lost population. And since then, what we've seen is that our taxes have been made fair. We have balanced our budget. We have gotten our finances in order by paying down a lot of debt that we had incurred during that decade. And as a result, job growth is up, income growth is up, we're regaining population. So, you know, we're still a long way from being a top 10 state, which is our goal, but we certainly have begun to turn around the economy.
And talk to us about how your updated turnaround plan then differs, given these improvements. How does this second turnaround plan differ from the first?
Well, we tried to recognize the progress that we've made and the work that still is left to be done. The most progress was on improving the business climate, the things that I talked about just a minute ago. But we still have more work to do to really invest in some of the infrastructure that we need and the education that we need for our kids to be able to get the jobs of the future. And we need to also do more work to try to grow an economy that's based on innovating, out-innovating our competitors in a variety of different ways.
So these recommendations can play out in a lot of different ways legislatively. How do we become, for example, more innovative?
Well, we say is that we need to do a better job at leveraging the assets that we already have that make Michigan special. We have terrific natural resources. We have a geographic location that positions us right in the middle of the NAFTA corridor between Canada and Mexico. We have a tremendous opportunity to build on the automotive industry that is changing rapidly to be more invested in high technology. If we do more by focusing our economic development efforts on those kinds of assets that we already have, we think we're going to accelerate job growth. An example would be, Mark, is that just in the last year, in the six assets that we've identified that we think really make Michigan special, we are actually growing jobs at two times the rate of the rest of the jobs across the state just in those six areas. And those jobs pay nearly two times more than the state average as well. So That's an example of trying to focus our efforts on things that matter most.
Speaking of pay, a Democratic candidate for Governor Mark Showers leading a charge to raise Michigan's minimum wage to $9.25 an hour. Right now it stands at $7.40. How do your members tend to feel about that?
Well, in general, we feel the market will determine what wages will be. I mean, back in the 1990s, when Michigan faced its last worker shortage, jobs that were just basically minimum wage jobs were paying, you know, 2-3 times the federal minimum wage. If you were going to McDonald's, you'd have to pay $10-$12 an hour to get people to work there. We think that's a better solution. But if you're going to change the minimum wage, I think if anything, we'd say do it at the federal level, because if one state does it over another, you start to put your own state at a relative disadvantage or advantage. And so in order to have a level playing field, probably federal action would be more appropriate.
Do you support the governor's proposal for more skilled immigrants for the city of Detroit?
We do, and we think actually more skilled immigrants for all of Michigan. We think as a state we need to grow population, and so we ought to be doing everything we can to try to attract more people to come here.
Yeah, the mantra of your updated turnaround plan is compete, invest, grow. Tell us more about some of the areas we haven't touched on yet.
Well, competitiveness is what, again, we've probably made the most progress in, but you're never done trying to compete and improve that because your competitors are constantly changing. So if it's something like, for example, getting rid of the personal property tax, a tax we still collect in Michigan, that would be an action that would make us more competitive. Investments are also important, and we think the most important would be in infrastructure and in talent. Those are the things that we think will most accelerate the economy in the future. And then growing is really about growing innovation. And that's about not just leveraging assets, as we just mentioned a minute ago, but also being welcoming to people, getting more people exposed and coming to the state to ensure that they have a perception of Michigan that is real, which is a very vibrant place to be.
Well, I mean, how do we become more hospitable? Do we, for example, expand the Elliott-Larsen civil rights measure to include sexual orientation? How far into tactics does your report go?
Well, we think that, you know, we just need to be attracting more people. That's kind of the mindset that we have. And so that involves things like trying to attract immigrants. We think out-of-state students, that's another opportunity for Michigan. Certainly, from a discrimination standpoint, we don't think we ought to be discriminating against anybody. But really, it's all about trying to ensure that people perceive Michigan as a place that they want to be. One of the things we learned, Mark, is that when people actually come to Michigan, they have a more favorable impression than if they don't. And so one of the very specific recommendations we have is let's become a more of a convening center. Let's get more conferences and meetings coming to Michigan so that we give people a first impression of what this place is like that they may not think of.
Business Leaders for Michigan has been pretty vocal in recent years on strengthening education and investment in education. Do you take positions on issues like the third grade reading bill or the EAA expansion?
You know, we haven't on those two specific issues, but in general, our feeling is that we ought to be expanding pre-K education, which the governor and legislature are doing. We ought to be doing everything we can to support K-12 education, and we've been very actively involved in supporting the adoption of the Common Core state standards and tying student assessments to those so that we can see how our kids measure up to their peers across the country, and also very involved in trying to make college more affordable because we know that more and more jobs are going to require an education beyond high school, and we need to make that education accessible to more people.
We're talking with Doug Rothwell, CEO of Business Leaders for Michigan, about his organization's updated Michigan turnaround plan. Doug, in general, are the measures occupying the legislature, occupying the Snyder administration recently, are these priorities encouraging to your members or more discouraging to your members?
Oh, encouraging. I think that what we see is that in the last 3 or 4 years that the governor and legislature have been in place, much of the action they have taken aligns very well with the recommendations that we've made in the Michigan Turnaround Plan. And I think that if you look at the output metrics, jobs, incomes, economic growth, the results speak for themselves. I think directionally we feel that we are moving in the direction that we should be. The only thing that we would say, and the reason why we're going out and having conversations like this right now is that there's still a lot of work to be done. We were a state that, you know, got ourselves into 50th out of 50 on most measures just a few years back. And we're now, you know, back on our feet again. We're, you know, back in the game. But we certainly can't lose that momentum right now. And I think that it's very easy for states, communities to feel good about where what we've accomplished, but not to let that get in the way of being complacent. That's really our enemy right now. And we've got to keep our energy level up to really keep moving forward.
A minute ago, you said that Michigan shouldn't be discriminating against anybody. Do you hope that efforts by the Attorney General to reinstate a ban on gay marriage fail?
We don't have any position on that. We don't really think that that's our place, Mark, to, you know, opine about, you know, the social contract, essentially. Our feeling simply is that as employers, we want to make sure that Michigan is, you know, seen as a great place to work.
But it can be argued that a gay marriage ban discriminates. Certainly, many people feel that.
Yeah, and again, we just have not, taken a position on that because we just don't feel it, our organization it's the right. We're in a position to be able to really have an opinion on that.
What's it like promoting a plan like this in an election year? I mean, is it easier generating attention in support, or is it harder?
I think it's really neither. I think it's more really just trying to maintain the interest level that we have seen in Michigan in the last 4 or 5 years towards taking a new path forward. You know, I think we let a lot of divisions get in the way of progress when we went through the economic collapse that we did, regional divisions, racial divisions, social divisions. I think what we see coming out of that is more collaboration and cohesiveness than we did in the past. And that's good because that is sending the message to the rest of the world that Michigan's the kind of place that has its act together.
Did your first turnaround plan have the impact that you hoped it would?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing that we feel that distinguishes our organization is we don't just put out plans, we track the results. And if you look at the results that have happened against the original recommendations that we put out, again, no big credit to us. We can't pass laws or, you know, implement much of anything other than just encourage people to do these things. We feel very good that a lot has been accomplished. Our challenge now is keep the momentum going.
And for our listeners who want to learn more about the Michigan Turnaround Plan or get involved more, what do they do?
Well, the easiest thing is to go to MichiganTurnaroundPlan.com. And specifically, what we'd encourage people to do is get involved in their regions, get involved in their local chambers, their local economic development organizations, and find out how they can have their own region work more effectively together and adopt many of the recommendations that we have in the turnaround plan for their own communities.
Doug Rothwell is the Chief Executive Officer of Business Leaders for Michigan. The organization's updated Michigan Turnaround Plan was just announced in Detroit. Doug, thanks for joining us. Good luck.
Thank you, Mark. You bet.
Many college students have heard lectures from their elders saying, "I worked my way through school, why can't you?" And they probably went to school uphill both ways. After hearing the speech from his grandfather, however, Randy Olson, an MSU graduate student, decided to calculate if it was still possible to work your way through college. He concluded, "It's not." Since posting his findings to his blog, he's received hundreds of comments, and The Atlantic wrote about his calculations. He told Current State's Emmanuel Berry that today's students have to work 7 times as many hours as their 1979 counterparts to pay for tuition alone.
What prompted you to write this blog post?
I just had a conversation with my grandfather over the phone. You know, we talk fairly regularly, and he kept talking about the virtues of working your way through college, you know, and how great it is and how good of an impact it can have on your life. And, you know, I said, sure, but from my experience, working through college and graduating without debt, that's the key part, wasn't feasible at all, right? And from talking with other millennials who went to college, I know it's not just me that struggled with working and paying their way through college. So this made me wonder, you know, why is it that millennials have such a different perspective on this problem of working your way through college than previous generations? So by coincidence, I ran across an online forum where students were talking about exactly this topic. So further confirmation that I'm not alone in this problem, right?
Yeah.
And one poster, they started talking about the historical MSU tuition trends and how its tuition has gotten way more expensive, especially in the past decade. And another person started relating this to federal minimum wage. And that's when it became really obvious to me why there's sort of this dissonance, this disagreement between our generations. So that's sort of what motivated me to write, I guess, this post that I did. It was really just a rant. I didn't expect it to blow up, but apparently it hit a tune with a lot of other students.
No, I think it definitely did. And I'm curious, what was your experience paying for school? I mean, did you work throughout college yourself? Or?
Yep. So I actually worked as soon as I graduated high school, I had to start working. My parents firmly said, you know, you start working now, even if it's at Walmart or wherever else, or you're getting kicked out of the house. So I worked even before I started college. And all through college, you know, I worked at a lot of, if not minimum wage jobs, close to minimum wage jobs. And then fortunately, I was studying computer science, so then I got computer programming jobs later on in my career. So yeah, I did manage to work through college. And even though I had a fairly, you know, decent paying job as a computer programmer, I still graduated with debt after 5 years.
So your blog post is titled, "It's Impossible to Work Your Way Through College Nowadays." Break down kind of this conclusion and the math that you did to get to this point.
Right. So the way I looked at it was, well, first, of course, I looked at the MSU tuition numbers. And I basically decided, okay, if you're taking, let's say, 24 credit hours a year, that's going to come out to a certain amount, and then I divide that by the minimum wage for that year. So that basically gives you a fairly relatable number of how many hours working on minimum wage would you have to work to pay for tuition for that year. So I did this for every single year between 1979 and 2013, and then I just plotted it in a very simple little line plot, and you just basically see this huge rise throughout the years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I originally wrote about. And I found that in 1979, an MSU student only had to work about 203 hours on minimum wage, which is something you can do basically in a summer, you know, serving ice cream or doing whatever else, you know, a fairly easy summer job. Whereas in 2013, an MSU student would have to work 1,420 hours to pay for the same education. So, I mean, we're talking about having to work full time for 35 and a half weeks of the year. And so just looking at that alone, and mind you, this is only looking at tuition and fees.
So we're not talking room and board, feeding yourself, all those other
exactly.
essentials.
Yeah. It's only looking at that. And so if you're already having to work most of the year full time just to pay for college, it's basically impossible if you're going to have to pay for everything else as well and survive without any debt.
One of the responses that I was seeing in the comments on your blog and Reddit and other places, well, what about financial aid? What about financial aid?
Right. So I looked at, I mean, I haven't done any in-depth analyses myself. I intend to soon, obviously. But from what I've seen, for example, federal aid, such as Pell Grants, they really haven't been keeping pace with the increase in tuition lately. You know, it started where back in, you know, the 1990s, It would pay for about 60% of your college tuition, whereas now it's dropped down to about 25 or 30% of your college tuition. So it's, if you combine the fact that that federal aid hasn't been keeping track and tuition has been going up faster and faster every year, I mean, we're really setting our modern day students up for financial failure, right? I mean, because the only option they have then is to either offload it on their parents, which in my case didn't
happen.
Not
an option for most
people. And most people are right. Or they put it on student loans, right? And so that's why we've also been seeing lately that in the past decade, more and more students have been turning to student loans and graduating with thousands upon thousands of dollars of debt.
You initially just calculated the working hours for an MSU student, and then you looked at other schools. Were the results similar?
Yes. So, of course, people were quick to point out when I wrote my initial rant that, you know, MSU is a top 100 elite research college, right, or research university. What about other universities around the U.S.? So then I had to go and find another data set for that that actually has all of the public four-year universities and their tuition rates for that time period. And I found a very similar trend when I compared 1979 to 2013. Now, it turns out MSU students actually have it worse than the average, but the average is still pretty bad. So according to that, in 1979, the average student would work about 182 hours on minimum wage to pay for a year of tuition, versus in 2013, we're talking 991 hours. So we're still talking, you know, 1979, you can pay off tuition with a summer job part-time, whereas you're having to work year-round as a modern student.
This story clearly resonated with a lot of people, as you said. Lots of comments on Reddit. It was picked up by The Atlantic, and there's hundreds and hundreds of comments on there. Why do you think that there's been such a strong reaction to just laying out the numbers and your rant after your conversation with your grandfather?
Right. Well, first and foremost, I think this, you know, as I hinted at earlier, I think this is really an issue that a lot of students are facing nowadays. You know, they're increasingly being told, why don't you work your way through college? Why can't you pay it off? You know, what's wrong with you? Why are you so lazy? And so this was sort of finally some real data, you know, that you can put your, you know, you can put your hands on and say, look, it actually is way harder than it used to be. And so I've had several people email me and comment saying, you know, I'm sending this to my parents right now. Finally, I have some validation, you know, showing that I'm not lazy, that it's, you know, that it's the system that's doing it for once. I'm not crazy. And I think another thing is the fact that it communicates it in terms of hours worked instead of just numbers, you know, because, or just, you know, thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. It, you know, when you're talking tuition, you're talking usually, you know, $10,000 or something like that. And it's easy to get lost in those numbers, especially when you have to take into account inflation and all these other things. Whereas, you know, if you just say, this is how many hours you have to work, you know, provided it's on minimum wage, I think that's a much more relatable number. So
a lot of people said they could relate, but there were also people who disagreed in comments saying, you know, my personal experience, I worked all through school. I managed to do it. What do you have to say to that?
Right. So also in the past couple of weeks, I've received a decent bit of hate now. And that's because people who are actually insulted by my claim that it's impossible to work through college, you know, they said, I just did it last year, or, you know, I guess I should tell my daughter that she just did the impossible or something like that. Mm-hmm. An important thing to remember when we're talking about, you know, averages and trends over multiple years and across the entire U.S., is that we're talking about the majority of people and their experience. Of course, there's going to be outliers and people that maybe made a good choice on their degree, and it was a very lucrative degree even while they were working through it, or they landed a good job or something like that. And of course, there's always going to be these exceptional people that are still able to pull it off. But it's important to remember that we're looking at averages and not just a special case.
Is this something you do often, like graphing things out, you know, calculating things that you want to make sense of?
Yeah, so as nerdy as it sounds, it's actually my weekend hobby.
Okay.
Almost every weekend, I'll try to find some interesting problem or something like that to tackle, and I'll go searching for a data set online, and I'll try to analyze it and visualize it, and then write a blog post about it. And, you know, sometimes it's interesting, you know, like obviously this one was. Sometimes it's not. But yeah, it's just been sort of a nerdy hobby for me to practice my computer science skills.
The student debt crisis, it's continuing to loom over the country. And we continue just hearing about it, but there's not really any concrete answers. Not really sure what the solution is or how it's going to be fixed. As someone who is going to graduate with a PhD in computer science from MSU in the next few years, I mean, what type of answers do you want? I know it's a tough question, but I thought I might as well ask.
What answers do I want? So there's been a lot of talk of student debt forgiveness, of, you know, just waiving off that student debt or something like that, or programs to help people pay off the student debt in a more reliable time span. I think something like that would really help. Because otherwise, if we just keep it as is and just let people continue to build up debt, it's really going to harm this next generation coming up that's currently in college.
Do you think the state should play a bigger role in helping with higher education funding?
Absolutely. So, I mean, that's one thing that was really interesting to find out, is that at least in Michigan, the state has been cutting funding to public universities. And I think that explains at least a big part of why tuition costs in Michigan, at least, have been skyrocketing, because, you know, the money has to come from somewhere. If it doesn't come from the state, well, then you put that burden on the students that are now going to the university. So I absolutely think that the state should recommit, you know, at least back to previous levels to help as a part of this crisis.
What are your plans post-graduation?
So I'm hoping to actually, I mean, even though I've been heavily criticizing academia here and the institution surrounding it, I hope to stay in it as part of a career. So I'm hoping to find a postdoctoral position in another state and continue doing my research there. And then if I'm lucky enough, maybe I'll get offered a professorship position somewhere, maybe at state.
Have you shown your blog post to your grandfather yet? Did you send it to him?
So I plan to talk to him about it this weekend. He's actually of the generation that refuses to go online, so he hasn't seen any of this. but I'm definitely looking forward to seeing and hearing what he says when I bring this data up to him.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Randy. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Randy Olson is a computer science PhD student at Michigan State University. You can check out more of his work for yourself at randallolson.com. For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
And that's our show for today. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also, Aaron Young for engineering and Kelsey Block for production assistance. I'm Joe Lindstroth in for Mark Bayshore today. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.